Peter the Schwitzer? Oh, yeah, it's the guy I listened to when I made my first billion. He's one clever son of a...
5, 4... We're online, the hottest internet station.
It's time for The Switzer Show with the guy who makes getting richer easier than running up a credit card bill, Peter Switzer.
Well, hello and welcome to The Switzer Show. I'm Peter Switzer and we have a show filled with very high-achieving women. My first guest is Naomi Simpson, the founder of that sensational business Red Balloon. You might know her from the Shark Tank. She's a shark, but she's also built a sensational business. And what she has stored in that grey matter of hers about building business, she's happy to share with you. So make sure you're hanging there. It's a great story. Then we have the legendary businesswoman and speaker, Catherine DeVry, and she's going to talk to you about motivating yourself if you're feeling a little bit demotivated, locked up at home and not in the workplace. Then we have the CEO of First State Super, Deanne Stewart. Now, her huge super fund is ridding itself of climate-challenging companies. Be interesting to see what companies are on the outer and which ones are going to be prevailed upon to clean up their act. That's Deanne Stewart later in the show. And finally, we have the ATO Assistant Commissioner, Karen Foate, on the tax office being coronavirus considerate. Yep. Even the ATO is being nice to property investors and in these challenging times. So if you are a property investor, what the ATO has got in store for you is definitely worth a decent listen to. Now, without any further ado, my special guest on The Switzer Show is Red Balloon's Naomi Simpson. I've known Naomi for at least 20 years. She'll probably correct me. And she's she's always been in a red dress. And when I first met her, she nearly always had a red balloon or two off her wrist. She's the founder of the experience business Red Balloon and many others. She's been a multiple business award winner and became famous as a shark on Shark Tank on Channel 10. Welcome, Naomi.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
It's a great pleasure. Well, apart from the fact that I do want to catch up with you, I just think you're a fantastic example for lots of people out there who are thinking about starting a business or having trouble growing their business. So you're the perfect person to talk to. But before we get into what you did and how you did it, how big is Red Balloon and the Red Group, I think it's called, isn't it?
Yeah, so the Big Red Group. So David Anderson and I created the Big Red Group just over 3 years ago, and I founded Red Balloon, as you know, way back in 2001.
Yes, I did
always carry a bunch of balloons around with me. You're quite right. And it's kind of sad that we don't do that now because helium isn't as accessible. It's a finite resource, so that's why we don't do it. But we created the Big Red Group with a thesis that we had access to 2,000 small businesses, all with amazing experiences across the spectrum from gourmet to adventure. And we wondered if there was different audiences for that same space because Red Balloon, of course, is famous for the experience gift. So over the last 2 or 3 years, we have acquired a number of brands in a similar space. So the Adrenaline, which is all about adventures, the weight, and we have Lime and Tonic, which is about the gourmet luxury experience. And so it's been a ride, but we're more than double the size we were 3 years ago, which is pretty good. And during this time where we saw on March the 11th when the World Health Organization announced the pandemic, of course, everything dropped off a cliff. We went from 85,000 visitors down to 8,000. But what we saw, as soon as people kind of picked themselves up and dusted themselves off, they're very much wanting to go out and do activities locally. So we've become a great source of content. And we're one of the few marketplaces that has access and also knows what's open.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case, and I think a lot of people have become stir crazy, and they are looking at the sort of things that can be done. And I must ask this question: are they looking for stuff that can be done, which is sort of by nature social distanced?
Yes, and one of the things that we've been working with our suppliers on is making sure that they comply. Believe it or not, flying is very popular. Any of our flying activities like helicopters and so forth, hot air ballooning is back, but there's less people in the balloon. So V8s were actually pretty quick to get back online because they were able to adjust their cars appropriately. So all of the different spectrums. The hardest thing, of course, is with the restaurants and those that have really limited space, in making sure that we've got enough seats. But people are patient. They're planning way in advance. They're looking forward to things. And one of the things that we did immediately was go back out to our small business and say, what else could you offer that perhaps could open audiences and customers anywhere? So immediately, especially with Victorian lockdown now, New South Wales and suburbs, what we did was with our existing suppliers who, you know, some of them I've worked with for 20 years, we invented new experiences at home. And so they're either experiences that can be delivered to home or to office or to workplaces, or that they can be done virtually. And within, you know, the space of a few months, we have more than 100 in that range. And so Little Bear is a gin distillery in Victoria that we'd work with, and they had distillery tours and so forth. And what he did was create a sample set of his gins that he now delivers, and then he takes people on a virtual tour. And that means that he, in fact, has got business growth because he's not just serving the 8 people that visit him for those tours. He can actually he literally has customers anywhere from Darwin to Perth, and he just ships the gin. And, you know, he sold 400 of those in the first month and had to employ people. So,
Naomi, as I was listening to you,
I do different things.
Yeah, well, as I was listening to you, I thought about people like you and me, and I'm sure in the number of speeches you've done and I've done, I've talked about how you always have to be, you know, forward thinking, risk managing, and all those sorts of things, doing a SWOT analysis on your business, looking at weaknesses and strengths, opportunities and threats. But people like us would never, and I was talking to Barry Markoff from ICMI only yesterday, and he said, Switzer, I never thought for one moment my business would go from 100 to nothing overnight. You know, in the event space, it's not the kind of risk management threat that we ever contemplated, but the consequence of it is that, in your own example then, businesses are starting to think outside the square and coming up with things that they would never have thought of unless they were threatened by something like this.
Yes, and I think that also speaks to the tech transformation that is going on in businesses. You know, there's this meme going around, who's driving your tech transformation, the CIO, the CEO, or COVID? Well, COVID's done a pretty good job of getting us all online, getting our systems and processes. And we had been wanting to change phone platforms. We've invested greatly in Salesforce. And this time, and even our productivity tools, we had been about to get along things done, but let me tell you, we got right onto that and made sure that everybody could be productive anywhere. So I think that it's really pushed the momentum and speed. And obviously also people realise you've got to have a good device. You've got to make sure that you can connect, and connection becomes everything, and the speed of connection and good technology. So okay. I'm sure that the technology companies are making money hand over fist.
Yeah, I think a lot of businesses will. And I must admit, I've looked at the local restaurant where I live, Bistro Moncur, and they're now delivering to home. Now, the guys who have owned that restaurant over the years have never, ever thought that a high-end restaurant like that would deliver to home. But I bet you once, you know, life goes back to normal, they'll keep doing deliveries. Why wouldn't they? It's extra business they never would have thought of before.
And they're utilising that asset. And with any of the, you know, restaurants, the capital investment is so great. Mm. But But I also think it's been quite interesting now how they require a credit card for a booking, because it's really important that, you know, if they've only got six tables they can serve, they better show up. Also, people are far more flexible. Mm. They're happy to have a serving time so they can get three services in an evening and utilise their kitchen by delivering from home to home. And people are wanting that experience. I also think it's quite nice how, you know, some of the top restaurants are doing cooking classes and delivering all the ingredients at home and teaching people their craft and the virtual, you know, cocktail making and all sorts. So those sorts of experiences we're finding people are loving and enjoying. And home definitely has a new meaning now because we spend so much time at home, whether it's working or you know, well, not really socialising, but how we're connecting with people. Yep. Home has a different meaning to it.
Mm. Now, I'm going to read from Wikipedia here, and it's to set me up for another question to you. Simpson, that's you, by the way, has won numerous awards throughout her career, including the 2005 Westpac New South Wales Entrepreneur of the Year. Additional awards and recognition include the National Telstra Business Women's Award for Innovation 2008, finalist in the BRW's Entrepreneur of the Year. And Simpson was recognised by LinkedIn in 2012 as one of the world's most influential thought leaders, a recognition shared by only 150 people worldwide. Now, that is absolutely fantastic, Naomi. And people reading that would say, I wonder how she did that. And I always knew you to be a great networker. But tell people how you did that.
Well, it's funny that you say I'm a great networker because I don't think I am, but I am deeply curious. So if I see a room full of people, not that I see that very often nowadays, but I'm just really interested in people and I do like putting people together. So for me, networking is not about what you get, it's about what you give.
Yep.
And I am forever introducing people to other people. I'm thinking, oh, they might be able to do that. And as such, you know, people look at me and go, well, that was really generous of her. She didn't have to do that. And it all kind of just flows around the system. So the way I became a writer for LinkedIn was the managing director here in Australia, Cliff. He at the time he was the one who said, you know, if you're going to launch this program of 150 thought leaders, you can't be US centric. You need people from outside of the US. And so I was selected from Australia with one other. And as it happened, I found, because I've been blogging for such a long time, so I started blogging because I was meeting people and I was learning so much. And also at that time I had young children. And so life was a bit of a blur. So I would write things down in my own blog as kind of a collector and keeping my ideas together. And so, and this was way back in the early days when nobody was blogging. You know, I've been blogging for 15 years and writing. And so therefore, I had this history, but when I went on LinkedIn, I found it was a very different sort of thing and people were far more interested in their career growth, their personal growth, and the sorts of things that I was writing and continue to write for LinkedIn has a different sort of flavour. It's more about the personal development, the career development, and versus my blog, which tends to be about being a business owner. And now I tend to spend more time profiling other people's businesses on my blog because, as I said, I love meeting people and I've had the chance this year of mentoring some amazing businesses in remote Australia.
Naomi, the Lady in Red concept, that's what you were when you, and it gave you enormous market identification. Was that actually a designed plan that you would always wear red, you'd always bring a balloon, and that's the way you would become, you know, in a person's mental hard disk forever?
Yes. Somebody said to me once, you look good in red, and at the time I didn't know what I was wearing and I'd, you know, scrape anything together. So I do know it's important to dress for others and, you know, if I had my way, I would be wearing something a little more casual. I look at all my red dresses in the wardrobe right now and I feel a bit sorry for them. They're not getting much of an outing nowadays. But I did do it because it was like a uniform. And like you, I'm on a stage, or I was on a stage a lot. And when they see the red dress, people kind of relax and go, oh, that's her. And somebody also said it will help people remember your message and what you said. So I did do that. I will continue to do that. It's just something that's it's just my uniform. This is work for me. And, you know, the wonderful thing is if I wear jeans and a T-shirt or something, nobody recognises.
Who was Naomi Simpson before you were the lady in red with a balloon?
Oh, it's a very long time ago. But I had worked in corporate marketing and I was very earnest and very committed to my career, and I got to work for some great brands. I worked for IBM and I worked for a company called Adset, which is a very long time ago, and I worked in their frequency and loyalty program, and I was one of the team that was on the launch of that. So I had incredible career as a marketer, and I also worked for Apple as well. And so I learned a lot from working for those big businesses and big brands, and I left corporate life. When I became a mum, I had little kids and I wanted to spend more time with them. But, of course, starting your own business is not necessarily going to happen how you think it's going to work out.
But the decision to jump out of corporate life and to start a business, and I don't think there was any business in Australia doing what you were doing then. There might have been, but it was certainly unknown. I guess there were some businesses overseas, and I guess that's another part of the question. Did you see stuff overseas and say, well, why aren't we doing this here? Or was this totally an original Naomi Simpson thought?
No, it's not a Naomi Simpson original idea. The name very much is. I remember that moment where when I was walking around the backyard saying, well, what are we going to call this thing? And I remembered a movie, I'm really dating myself, a 1956 Charles movie called The Red Balloon, which is a beautiful Academy Award-winning French children's movie about this little boy, his best friend's balloon. And I thought, wow, if people saw any red balloon and they smiled and remembered the first red balloon experience they gave or that they were given, and it's such a symbol of festivity and party and joy that, for me, it was a natural, it just made so much sense to call a gifting experience business Red Balloon. But in the UK, there was a business called Red Letter Days, which was a catalogue and call centre business. And one of my clients, when I left corporate life, I was a freelance marketer, and one of my clients said, you know, this tech wreck's going on, I really think that we should find something else. What about this red letter days as a concept? And it really needed, you know, in Australia, a big land with a small population, and a catalogue and call centre was never going to work here, but the internet was just coming of age. And I didn't realise what a trailblazer I really was when it came to creating a marketplace, a two-sided marketplace. Mm. Now we see a lot of them. Not necessarily in our space, but two-sided marketplaces. But it was one of the originals. I just didn't realise at the time.
When you reflect upon it, and I know you in your younger days, which weren't all that far ago, you were a member of the Young Entrepreneurs Organisation, which nowadays I think is called the Entrepreneurs Organisation. Was that an important part of your growth as an entrepreneur and business owner, to hang out with others, people who had done it before you or people who were doing it at the same time? Was that a good thing for you and the growth of your business?
Well, I think it's really, really important to learn from other people's experience wherever you can. And that was the premise of the organisation, which is that you shared your experience and what you were learning. And there's quite a number of organisations that do a similar sort of thing. Young President's Organisation is one. There's Tech. There's quite a number. But at that particular time, the group that I was in, we all decided that we were going to play to be on the BRW fast growing list. Like, we just as a group came together and said, what would it be like? So we were very we were very entrepreneurial. We were pushing really hard. And the people that were in that group are still great friends. In fact, one of them was Scott Farquhar. Some just grew their businesses a bit bigger than others.
Yeah, Scott Certain with Atlassian. did grow the business. And, yeah, I guess James Stevens from Roses Only was in that group as well in those days.
Yeah, he was in the EO group, but he wasn't in our little pod. He wasn't in that group of eight. There was only eight of us, four women, four blokes, and we were pushing really, really hard to grow. Emma Isaacs was in that group. Narelle Anderson, she's got a fabulous business in recycling and environment and waste. No, there it was, and David Anderson, who is now my business partner. Mm. So, no, it was a very special group, and one of the guys from Safety Conscious. So, yeah, it was only eight of us, but we challenged each other, and I think that's the point of this conversation: is how do you have peers around you who won't just say all the right things of the things that you think you should be doing or should be saying, and often that they will say, you know, people will literally just say what you want them to say. And we see that on, you know, Shark Tank when people, you know, they've had, so who thinks this is a good idea? Well, mum thinks it's a great idea. My friends think it's a great idea. Oh, well, we don't think it's a great idea, you know. So I think that that's, we need people to challenge us to greatness and people from outside our sphere, but who have, who are speaking from their own experience.
Now, Amy, the biggest mistake you made and what you learnt from it?
Well, going into business with my now ex-husband, you know, it was good and it was bad. It was good because he was there. It was really a tough separation after 10 years of having Red Balloon together. And it took me 6.5 years to get the business back. So that's a whole nother book and a whole nother story, and one day I'll tell it.
Okay.
But that really was a tough story, and I don't think your podcast is long enough to hear the detail.
No, we'll do that on another occasion when the book's ready. But, all right, so the greatest decision you made and why?
The greatest decision that I made was actually starting my own show and remaining deeply curious. And that is not assuming that I know everything, not assuming that I think many entrepreneurs can become complacent. I realize it's not me. Mm. I was at the right place at the right time with the right idea, and I consistently kept executing and trying new things. And I'm still trying new things literally today.
The biggest influence on you to explain your performance in business, whether it be someone you knew or a book you read or a well-known business thinker who influenced you, who would that be and why?
Vern Harnish with his Gazelles was a big influence, but it actually happened way earlier than that. As a child, my mother, a systems integrator, worked in computing, and she worked for one of Australia's great entrepreneurs, a woman by the name of Lindsay Catamol, who had the business Aspect Computing. Mm. And as a teenager, my mum would take me to their social events, and I would sit and look at Lindsay Catamol. And, you know, I was just a young girl in the distance. But Lindsay did say to me at one of these events, she said, "You can do whatever you want to do. You've just got to do it and do the work." And I thought that that was really interesting. And years later, I have got to connect with Lindsay, and she didn't realise at all what a big role model she was in my life. And on the way home from that event, my mum said, "Seriously, if she can do it, you can do it." So I've always had people who have believed in me, and I think you just need one person who does believe in you, and it's amazing what you can get done.
Naomi Simpson, thanks for joining us on The Switzer Show.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Naomi Simpson. What a great story. I could have talked to her for a lot longer, but it's time for an ad. And what we're pushing this week is that brilliant book called Join the Rich Club. You know who wrote it. I know I'm a little bit immodest, but I care about you. You know, this is something I wrote, which I think is really easy to read, and I think it is the basic foundations of building your wealth. Have a look at it. Just go to switzerstore.com.au. It'll cost you $24.95 plus postage and handling, and it'll be the best small outlay you'll ever do. Well, at a time when a lot of us have felt demotivated, being locked up and wondering what our future is going to be like, I thought it'd be great to catch up with an old friend of mine, Catherine DeVry, from greatmotivation.com. What a great website. And Catherine historically has been known on the speaking circuit as someone who was a leading a female executive from large US company, IBM. I seem to think you were from, Catherine. Am I right in remembering that?
Yes, I was with IBM for over 10 years, both here and Tokyo and Hong Kong.
Yeah, and I think when I first met you, I don't know if you were still working for IBM, but certainly you were big on the speaking circuit, and there weren't very many women on the speaking circuit in those days.
No, there weren't. I've been doing it for over 24 years now, and it has changed, and it's great to see more diversity out there. So. Yeah. Wonderful experiences.
Let me go back in time when I first started to hear you speak, and I always wondered what it is that you did that a lot of other women hadn't done at that time to get that kind of promotion in a big US company like IBM.
Well, I don't know if I did anything particularly different. I'd often worked in predominantly male environments. And I, you know, never really thought of the gender thing in those days. I thought of doing the best job I could at the time. I used to play a lot of competitive team sport, and I believe that helped me in terms of understanding that I couldn't always be the one that scored the goals. And before I worked for IBM, I was actually director of sport for the Victorian government and involved in establishing the Life Being It campaign with a number of other colleagues. So, I was very fortunate, I think, to be at the right time and the right place with IBM, and I had the credentials and I had the educational background they wanted, and they gave me some wonderful opportunities. They sent me to Harvard and, you know, worked in the States. And I am Australian, Canadian by birth, Australian by choice, but I've lived here most of my life, but I still have the accent.
Now, Catherine, when you first came to the speaking circuit, you know, you weren't there to specifically talk to women, though I'm sure a lot of women were inspired by the fact of your CV and the fact that you were there giving inspiration and business education to anyone in business. What do you think are the key messages that people need to grasp to go from being a normal performer to being an abnormal performer? Because that, in a sense, was always, I always thought, even myself, that was the challenge. If people are going to pay us to speak to a group of people, in a sense, you need to come with a message that might really resonate with people who have the potential to be much better performers. What did you find was the best message, the best secret you shared that you thought had the biggest impact on lifting people from one level to the next?
Wow, could I have an easier question, please, Peter?
No, because you're capable of doing it, because clearly that was your job. Like, my job was easier than yours. I talked about the economy. I then talked about what great business performers did and the lessons that I drew from that. But you tended to work on the motivation, and that's the name of your website, greatmotivation.com.
Yes, but it didn't always start out that way. And as you said, I think I probably got a name on the speaking circuit quite early because I was the Telecom Australian Executive Woman of the Year back in 1994, I believe. And so that gave me, a platform. But my first books weren't on motivation as such. My first books were on living in Japan and on customer service, where I came back from working with IBM in Japan, totally committed to the concept of service and quality when it was very new in Australia. And Good Service is Good Business went on to be a number one bestseller both here and in other countries. So that initially launched me onto the speaking circuit with a very specific message, just like you had a very specific message on the financial side of things. And then clients came back to me. I never did any advertising. I never did any social media or anything like that. But clients like American Express or some of the big banks would come back to me and said, "Look, we loved what you said about customer service, but we're undergoing amazing change at the moment. We're restructuring, we're whatever. Can you put together a message on change?" So I wrote another book on change, and that sort of then I had two topics, customer service and change. Mm. And then when my memoir came out, it became more of the so-called motivational, inspirational. So now I had the three messages that were in quite different lanes. So that's why I was struggling with your question, because there was no secret to how I connected with an audience. It would depend on the briefing I had for the client. Sometimes they wanted a little bit of customer service, a little bit of change. Sometimes they wanted a lot of inspiration and motivation and overcoming adversity. And if they said they wanted something that I couldn't deliver, I would tell them that. But it was always very customized, because I truly do believe that you don't, as a speaker, I consider myself an author who speaks. Mm. And I think that what you say on stage has to be timeless.
But can I interrupt? Yeah. Because the thing, that, and I know my own experience that speaking after a number of years, is that you realize that you're asked to be ultimately in a leadership position. You're being asked to share something that others may not discover by themselves, and that's why you're asked to attend a conference and to share those insights. And you, at the time I first started, I was a much smaller business than I am today. But the one thing people like you and I learn is that when you're in a leadership position, you do actually have to learn a lot, because I don't believe there are natural born leaders. You actually learn a lot of it on the job when you have to give something to the people who are following you. Yeah. So they can go to the next level. And I remember once doing a speech for Metcash, for the IGA group of supermarket owners, and I remember just stopping in the middle of the speech and saying to the group, "I'm offering you a whole lot of stuff that I think is really valuable, but I got a suspicion that you might go back to your supermarkets tomorrow and just be the same normal people." I said, "Hands up anyone who'd like me to email you on a weekly basis when I come across something new that is changing me and therefore might change you." And I must admit, one-fifth of the audience put their hands up. And I thought, that was something I'd never thought of before, that I needed to do more than just talk to them and hope they got the message. So along the way, did you get that kind of realization that you had to do more to deliver to the people you were talking to?
I think maybe not more, but maybe more relevant, might be the way I looked at it. Mm. I always, like, you say IGA, I've spoken to them as well. And when I was at university, I was a checkout chip for 4 years. Mm. So I was able to really relate to them and tell, some relevant stories about being a checkout chip, which I probably didn't share when I spoke to Rolls-Royce or Microsoft or, the BBC, because I think one of the things that does inspire people, and it's a very old saying, I don't even know where I heard it, but if people are turned into that radio station called WIIFM, what's in it for me? Mm. And I think to survive on the speaking circuit, to survive as a leader, you, whether on the speaking circuit or in any sort of business, to get your troops to follow you, to get people to follow you, you have to give them something that is going to actually be useful to them, not just to hear the sound of your own voice. And one of the things I think that motivates people is giving them a why. Why should they change their behavior to give better service? Why should they change their behavior to adapt to change? Why should they change their behavior in terms of becoming more resilient and bouncing back from setbacks? And I found story is the best way to do that. Backing, often having some facts or some research, but backing it up with some real life stories that people can identify with, and also being authentic, not to say, well, gee, look at me, I'm off on stage and I'm so wonderful, but how you've overcome maybe some adversity yourself, and then a lesson that might help resonate with them.
Well, look, Catherine, let me continue to put you on the spot. I only put people.
You're good at that.
I know. Well, I only put people on the spot who I admire, because I think you've got talent and you've got insights. And secondly, I'm always in the business of self-improvement. So if I hang out with people who can teach me stuff, it's great for me, and I figure my audience will like it as well. We've all gone through an unusual period. Lots of people have been locked up in their homes. Businesses have had to adapt to a new world in running their business. I know I was just talking to Barry Markoff, who I'm sure you know, and from ICMI, and Barry said, I would never have thought any time in my life that I had to do risk management where I would lose 100% of my business for a couple of months. And he said, and I've got speakers out there who might earn $1 million a year who are earning nothing at the moment. He said, they would never expected it. So have you thought about the message that you would say to people who may be feeling at the moment that all of this is a little bit too much for them?
I would say to them that they're probably not Robinson Crusoe and they're not feeling alone. But yet when you do feel, as you know, every conference has been canceled. My next conference is June 17th, 2021. Mm. So, and speaking has been my main source of income, and because all the royalties from my books go to charity. So I guess what I would say to them is focus on what you can change and don't waste a lot of energy, negative and self-pity, worrying about stuff you can't change. And it's a message I've had to remind myself about as well, because I've got to tell you, over the last few months, because I speak all over the world now, I love traveling. And so I've not only lost my income, I've lost my travel, which is my passion. And I've had to remind myself of that. In fact, one of my very good friends a few months back said to me when, you know, the COVID was kind of the reality of it was hitting, said, hey, why don't you read one of your own books and listen to some of your own messages? Because I wasn't feeling very much like a motivational speaker. And I had to revisit some of those, I guess, timely messages. And one of the ones that I love, I'm an ocean swimmer. I live at Manly, and being fortunate enough to be able to walk and swim and cycle and do outdoor things as we are in Australia, one of my favorite sayings is the man who swims against the tide knows the strength of it. And, you know, when you have had adversity in the past, you sort of, you know, you can get through it. Whereas I think as younger people who may not have had adversity, it may be even harder for them. I remember I had the same feeling after 9/11 when I was the keynote speaker at the World Airline Conference in Brisbane on 9/11. And the topic was, you can't control change. You can only control your attitude towards change. And of course, all of our business on the speaking circuit and elsewhere evaporated at that time as well. So I think we have to look, you know, focus on what we can change, and really there's always something that we can do, even though we often do feel hopeless. And I think it's never, you should never be too proud to reach out for help, because when I first came to Australia, I arrived with a backpack, $200 and a one-way ticket for a 3-month holiday. And my life was at an all-time low, because both I just graduated from university and my life was going according to plan, well, according to my plan anyway. When the year I graduated from university, both my parents died. God. And I was an only child. And you wouldn't have known that, Peter, because when I never spoke about it when I was speaking about customer service or managing change. I was too proud to ask for help. I didn't know how to deal with grief. And then when my memoir came out, which was only, 10 years ago or so, when I won the telecom executive, it was the telecom in those days, that shows how old I am. It's now the Telstra Businesswoman's Award. Journalists said, why is it, how is it that a Canadian came to win the Australian Executive Woman of the Year Award? And that's when I shared, that my parents had died. And it was just, I had it all bundled up. Now I can tell that story. I can actually make it quite funny from stage, but I was too proud to ask for help. And I don't think any of us should be too proud to ask for help when we're going through these tough times.
Yeah, that's a really good message. Catherine, if people want to, you know, catch up with you, what's the best way of doing it?
Probably the best way is to send me an email, which is office@greatmotivation.com. Great. I'm always on email. Okay. And I think people just need to be reminded to, you know, look after themselves. And again, when I came to Australia, I boarded with an elderly couple in Melbourne called Frank and Betty Jansen. And Frank said that every problem has an opportunity and you've got to make the best of it. And he said, cast every day above the ground is a good one. So we have to kind of keep perspective. And as I said, I think everyone's going through tough times at the moment, pretty much everyone. And we've got to look at timely and timeless stuff that will help us get through and be persistent.
Catherine, thanks for joining us on The Switzer Show.
Thank you so much, Peter, and hope to see you on stage again in the not-too-distant future.
That's for sure. And that was Catherine DeVry. Now it's time for another ad, and this time we're pushing the Switzer Report. Now, of course, the Switzer Report is basically a stock investment ideas newsletter. We'll give you a 21-day free trial to see if you like it. You get access to our weekly Boom, Doom, and Zoom stock tip show, which you can Zoom into, and plus three reports, one on Monday, Thursday, and Saturday, once again, with a whole lot of really good stock investing ideas. That's the Switzer Report. So go to switzerreport.com.au/subscribe. It'll cost, John, what does it cost? Come on.
$397,
yes. He does have a voice. $397, and it's the best $397 you'll ever spend if you're interested in investing in the stock market. Well, my next guest is the CEO of First State Super, Deanne Stewart. Now, before you go to sleep, I have mentioned the word super, and some people think that's an instant reason to go to sleep. Not me, of course. As one of Australia's largest super funds, First State Super has taken a leading role in the climate change response, releasing an updated roadmap for how the fund would support the transition to a low-carbon economy. And the lady who's leading that is Deanne Stewart. Deanne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter.
Okay, Deanne, why don't you tell us how important is it for the super sector to take the lead on lowering emissions?
Well, look, I certainly think climate change is one of the biggest issues we need to face into, both globally and here in Australia. And everyone's got to do their bit, whether that be community, government, corporations, and certainly super funds. If you think about super funds now, close to $3 trillion. We represent more than 150% of the GDP, 150% of the ASX. So there's certainly power in the capital of super funds. So I think the role super funds need to play is to be very clear about the risk it provides in portfolios over the next 5 or 10 years, but also the opportunities, and make sure that they have a very clear plan, targets in place, and importantly are transparent with their members as to what they're doing and how they're really managing the climate change risk.
Now, Deanne, you'd be aware, and I've actually interviewed the guy in question. I forget his name now. I think he was a gardener, and he took on his super fund because he didn't think they were respecting the threat from climate change. Were you prompted by or even poked by your members to be, you know, committed to making changes about how you invest the members' money? Or was it something that the fund decided needed to be done on a risk management basis?
Yeah, it's actually been something that the fund has been working on for a long time. So we've certainly been a leading advocate and super fund in the area of climate change. In fact, back in 2015, we created a really detailed plan that was essentially called our Climate Change Adaption Plan. And at that point, it was, how are we going to actually begin to really de-risk the portfolio, where you look at physical assets, particular stranded assets, but also how do we begin to really engage with companies and ensure that they are addressing the climate change risk. So we began it really back in 2015. What we're doing now, though, is really taking it one step further and really looking at how do we begin to transition the whole portfolio to make sure that it's sustainable for the long run. And once again, I think that's quite leading. If you look at some of our members, though, we're certainly open to all Australians, but given the background of First State Super, we certainly have a lot of healthcare workers, teachers, doctors, public servants, and they are very aware of climate change and the risks that that poses, not just from an overall environment, but also a health risk and the physical risk. So we're certainly very supported by our member base, I would say. But, yeah, it's something that we've been really passionate about for a long time.
I would have thought that at least a minority of less committed people might have said to you, hang on, it's a really noble idea, but end of the day, your job is to make sure you get really good returns. So the money that I've sacrificed, you know, because, you know, remember – people do sacrifice for the long term, so the money will be there. How can you be sure? I'm sure some people have said to you, how can you be sure that the returns will be as good, if not better, because of the road you've decided to go down?
Yeah, it's actually a really good point. We are making these moves not because of values, but because of valuation, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And there is always a degree of risk. So that is the nature of investing. You've got to weigh up the risks and the opportunities in front of you and essentially pivot and put the portfolio in a direction that you think really takes into account the mega trends occurring. And for us, the trends of climate change and therefore the physical risks, the stranded asset and financial risks and the reputational risks are starting to really outweigh in certain areas such as thermal coal. And so we actually think in terms of providing our members with the best possible returns over the medium to long term, this is the right move to be making. So it is actually being made on a valuation base. But I absolutely take your point.
Mm. Because I could imagine, you know, you could easily say, well, look, you know, we got out of Whitehaven Coal years ago and look what's happened to that company that's really struggled. Yeah. But on the flip side, someone might say, well, you got out of BHP, I'm not sure whether you are, and BHP has not only done well on capital, it's actually become one of the great dividend payers in the market. So I guess it's a fair question. Are you out of the big miners like BHP and Rio, or is that something you're watching to see whether these guys actually change their game as they're kind of promising, or are they already out?
Yeah, no, that's a really good distinction to make. So the only thing we're divesting from is thermal coal. So that is the pure play thermal coal players like, as you said, Whitehaven and Stanmore. But the big diversified players like your Rio, your BHP, we are significant investors in. And what we do on that front is really engage with them. And what we're engaging on is, what is your transition plan? Over the next decade, how are you looking to reduce your carbon so that our portfolio and carbon emissions go down, your impact on the climate goes down, and you're sustainable into the future? So we're actually really, we believe that the power of engagement at that level is important to protect our members' returns. You're right. And that stops the volatility in the actual portfolio by actually, you know, just simply divesting from all of those. We would only divest if we really think that the valuation is likely to go south from here on. Mm. Other than that, we look to engage to actually really reduce the carbon emissions and have a very clear transition plan.
Mm. As I was listening to your answer, it reminded me of a unit I was forced to do because of the Hayne Royal Commission, because all financial planners were deemed to be unethical. And so they made every financial planner do 60 hours of study, of which a lot of it was ethical, but also some of it was looking at what the big super funds are doing. And one of the units actually pointed out that many of the super funds like yours wanted to remain shareholders so they could actually prevail upon big miners to be better corporate citizens.
Yeah, and look, I think we've got a really critical role to play in regards to things like that, whether it be corporate conduct, whether it be climate change, whether it be modern slavery, for example.
Mm.
And the reason that we
I've done that too. I've done a unit on modern slavery as well, Deanne, by the way.
There you go. Well, I don't know if you remember, but I told you last time we caught up that you were my professor. So maybe it's you will know how I felt doing 101 economics with you.
Okay, fair enough.
But anyway, I digress.
Mm.
No, I think the reason we do engage is exactly to your point. One of the the lovely things about working for a super fund is that you do get to think about the long term. It is about members' retirement. It's not about, you know, the quick buck over the next month. And so that engagement and the view of a sustainable long-term value creation is really important. And so engaging with companies to make sure that they're considering financial and non-financial risk and reputation risk and their role in society is equally valid.
Okay. There's one last question, and it's sort of off script, but I'm sure you have a view on it. Obviously, the coronavirus encouraged the government to do something that really the Treasurer wouldn't have wanted to do, namely allow people to access their super. But it was clearly advised by the economists, those terrible economists in Treasury, that it was an initiative that was needed for the economy. How worried are you about the fact that people have taken a lot out of super and it may well affect their final nest egg if they don't make up and make a contribution when times get better?
Yeah, look, we've certainly been supportive of the government's move to allow early access. This is a hopefully a one in a 100-year type of event, right? And there are many Australians facing huge financial hardship. So enabling Australians to access their super and be able to actually get through this period of time, I think is a valid reason for opening up the super. I think what we would be really worried about is if this became a trend and it was opened up for many other matters, because ultimately all that does is harm most working Australians' ability to actually have a really good nest egg for their retirement, which, while it's not necessarily something we all want to think about today, we know that that's vital for the future. So it's probably more from here not wanting to see it opened up again and again for all different sorts of causes. That's where I would be really worried.
Good point. Deanne Stewart, CEO of First State Super, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Now, joining us on the program now is the Assistant Tax Commissioner, Karen Foate. Karen, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, well, here's some questions a lot of people would like to know the answers to, and I think you're the right person to answer them. There's been a lot of attention in the media about rental properties. What are the main things rental property owners should be aware of this tax time?
Yeah, great question. Look, we understand that the COVID-19 pandemic has placed property owners and tenants in unforeseen circumstances, as with everything at the moment. But for rental properties in particular, this might be, you know, as a result of tenants paying reduced rent, not being able to pay their rent at all, or entering into deferred payment plans. And of course, when it comes time to tax time, that will also mean some changes for rental property owners' tax returns. So where rental income is reduced or deferred, property owners really only need to include in their returns the rent that they've received when they receive it. So if they're receiving less, they only need to declare that smaller amount. And if they're receiving it later, then they'll declare it when they actually receive it. And of course, property owners are going to be very interested in the other side of the equation in regards to their expenses, because whilst reduced income has been coming in, many property owners continue to have their normal expenses. And property owners can continue to claim those things as long as the reduced rent charged is determined at arm's length and having regard to the current market conditions.
Right. So what about short-term rental properties? Is there anything special these people need to think about this year?
Yes, some of the same principles apply. So if you've had reduced demand due to COVID-19 or natural disasters earlier in the year, then as long as the property was still genuinely available for rent, then you can still claim your regular deductions. However, we have seen a lot of people deciding to use their short-term rental properties differently this year. So if people have changed how they use it, they've made a decision to stop seeking to rent it out, or they're using it themselves, or they've lent it to family and friends, then of course they can't claim deductions for those periods.
Okay, so what sort of support is the ATO providing to people this year, including for small business owners who may be recovering from bushfires, impacted by COVID-19 and other curveball circumstances?
Great question. Look, we understand that tax is probably not the top of a lot of people's list at the moment, but it might be weighing on their minds a little bit. Look, in tough times like these, the most important thing is to look after yourself and your loved ones. And look, we do understand that. Look, small businesses in particular are having a really tough time. So we do have some information about small business mental health on our website, and I would encourage small business owners to check that out. It's at ato.gov.au/small biz mental health, and the biz is B-I-Z. So definitely check that out. And remember, the ATO is not always the big bad guy. I know sometimes that is the reputation that we have, but absolutely, we understand businesses are doing it tough. So if you're in that situation and your tax obligations are weighing on your mind, the best thing you can do is get in touch with us, or get your tax agent too if you use one, and we can work with you to help get you back on track.
Well, Karen, I know your boss, Chris Jordan, pretty well, and he looks like a big scary guy, but both you and I know inside he's an old softy, isn't he?
Yeah, look, we try and be pretty fair and reasonable with people, and look, we know people are doing it tough.
Karen, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on the program.
And that's the show for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. Getting inside the head of someone like Naomi Simpson is a great way not only to build a business, but even to think about you building your own personal brand. People who don't own a business, they have a brand, and that brand needs to be built up. And that's the way you get noticed. That's the way you get promotions. That's the way you actually, you know, go up in the organisations that you're working in. And people like Naomi, and next week I'll be talking to Luke Mangan, the famous celebrity chef. These sorts of people are really good for showing you the way of lifting your game. Thanks for joining us. I'll talk to you next week.
Ooh.